speak about some of the things from the Sedra, and then a little bit about the 3 weeks. The Sedra starts with the kanos, the zealousness of Pinchas, who sees this tremendous travesty of honor of the Rabbanu Shel Olam, Nasi committing this terrible sin publicly, and Jewish people are being killed because of it. There's a terrible plague, and out of a sincere desire to save Klal Yisrael, he kills the two evildoers, and he's given a tremendous reward. According to some, he lives forever. And he's Pinchas as Eliyahu, and he becomes a Kohen, and he has Brisi Shalom because of this. When is zealousness okay, and when it's not okay? So I want to mention two conditions. One condition is what Reb Chaim Brisker says. He says that there's two kinds of kanoim. There is, and he gives an example. He says if you have a mouse loose in the house, there are two zealots who want to get rid of that mouse. The housewife and a cat. There's a very big difference, though, between their motivations. The housewife would rather that there aren't any mice in her house, and she's hoping there'll never be any more mice, but as long as there's a mouse, she has to get rid of it. The cat, on the other hand, is hoping there'll be plenty of more mice, and he'd be very sad if there weren't mice in the house. He enjoys getting rid of mice because he enjoys it. He says those are the two kinds of zealots. There are people who say, look, if there is a Chilul Hashem, people are being mechal Shabbos publicly or whatever, we have to protest. We have to do something. Can't just sit by idly like the Mesillas Yesharim says. If somebody loves someone very much, right, loves his parents, and somebody comes and curses them or hits them, he can't stand by idly and not react. Right? It would show that he's indifferent to the honor of his parents, and it's somebody he loves. So if somebody who loves the Rabbanu Shel Olam and sees his honor being trampled, right, has to react. But the person would rather that he didn't have to do that, better that everybody should be free. Somebody who gets up on Friday and says, I hope that this Shabbos, they're going to close all the parking lots and there's not going to be any Chilul Shabbos, and I'll be able to stay home and enjoy a nice, quiet Shabbos. But if not, I'm going to have to go out and protest. I can't just remain indifferent. That's a good kanoi. The person who says, oh, wow, I hope they open another parking lot this Shabbos because it's exciting, right? And there'll be action, and it'll be a boring Shabbos if there's no hafganot. That's apostle kanoi. Both doing the same thing, but one's coming from a good motivation, one from a negative one. There's another condition. And that is the end doesn't justify the means. Kanos is not where you do something wrong because your end goal is good. Right? I want to champion the cause of Shabbos, therefore I trash somebody's car was not doing anything. Right? That's the end justifying the means. The means is wrong. There's no heter to damage people's property for covered Shabbos. Right? Especially people who are not necessarily involved bichlal. But you're doing it because you think the end justifies the end doesn't justify the means. Not in Yiddishkeit. Pinchas did what he did. The halacha was like that. That haboil aram is a person who lives publicly with a non-Jewish woman is kanoim pogimbo. That's somebody who feels so incensed has the right to kill them. It's a right thing to do. It's not that it was a murder, but for a good purpose. It wasn't murder. But if the halacha wouldn't have condoned it, then it would have been a wrong thing to do, even if the goal was a good thing. So those are the two conditions, at least two of the conditions. One is that the thing intrinsically that you're doing has to be okay. And that you're doing it totally out of a feeling of covet for the Rabbana Shel Olam, not because you want to get some kind of side enjoyment from it, whatever. And I would think a third one is, you're doing it not out of hatred for the evil, but out of love for Klal Yisrael, for the Rabbana Shel Olam, and you feel this is an affront to, it endangers the Jewish people, and it's an affront to the Rabbana Shel Olam. Memela, I hate evil because I love good so much. But not it's a negative feeling, it's an offshoot of a positive feeling. Those are three conditions. Okay, let's go on to another topic from the Seder, because I really want to cover the 3 weeks also a little bit. Right after this, we have the census before they leave the desert. Again, they're counted. And here, the names of the families are all preceded with a hey and end with a yud. Lechanoch mishpachas hachanochi. Lefalu mishpachas hapalui. So all the names have a hey and a yud attached to them. So the Chazal say there's a reason for that. Because God wanted to take two letters of his name, the hey and the yud, attach them to the Jewish people to show that they remained pure and were not, tainted by the Egyptians when they were there. Because the nations of the world said, if they ruled over your body, surely they ruled over your wives and daughters. So probably there was a lot of Egyptians that were mixed into the Jewish people. Right? A lot of cross-breeding. Can't call it intermarriage, and married. And the Torah says, no, it's not true. We remained, except for one instance, in the whole 210 years we were there, right? The Makalel, which we had in Parshas Emor, right? The person who cursed God's name, whose mother was violated by an Egyptian, and he was the offspring. Father was an Egyptian, the mother was a Jew. That was the only exception. And she didn't do it on purpose. She was raped. So otherwise, they remained pure genealogically. And those were converted. Those whatever conversion was at the time, they converted. And therefore, the Rabbana Shel Olam put his name stamp on the Jewish people, the hey and the yud, as a stamp of that they were pure. Why those two letters, the yud and the hey of God's name? Because it says ish ve'isha shchina shruya b'neihem. Right, ish has the yud of God's name in his name. And the Isha has the hay. Without the Yud and the hay, it's Esh. It's fire. Okay? But if they have the Yud and the hay, they become Ish v'Isha, and then God's name is amongst them. So the hay represents the woman. The woman has the hay, and the man has the Yud. We'll see in 1 second what the significance is. And since in Egypt, it was the women who were the most significant, because in the Schus of Noshim Tzidkonios, in the schus of the righteous women in Mitzrayim, we were redeemed. The men weren't all so great, but the women were fine. Right? They were extra special. So it was their merit that got us out of Egypt. Therefore, the hay comes before the yud. The hay, the women, the hay, and then the yud at the end of the name. Now, that whole idea that man and woman, when they live properly together, God's presence is amongst them, why is it only represented by two of the letters of God's name? That's only half the name, Yud and Hey. God has two other letters in his name, Vav and Hey. And in fact, a half of the name, when it mentions only half the name, it's not a good thing. Because it says, as long as Amalek is in the world, God's name isn't complete, and there's only Yud and Hey. But the Vav and the Hey is not there. So why would the Torah want to intimate God's presence amongst man and wife, just with the yud and the hay? Why isn't there a connection to the vav and the hay too? That's one. Second question, how does it work? So I was thinking like this. We once explained, I think before Purim, obviously, this concept that God's name isn't complete when a Moloch is around. And we explained it the following way. The Yud, God's name, Yud Kei Vav Kei, means simply, the simplest basic idea, or not the simplest, but one of the simplest basic ideas is Hoya Hove Yihye. God is, was, and always will be. Okay? And therefore, the Yud and the He represent Yihye and Hoya, because those are the words you can make with a Yud and a He. All you have to do is repeat them. There's no extra letters. Either it's He, Yud, He is Hoya, or Yud, He, Yud, He is Yihye, only Yuds and He's. But you can't make Hove, present. For Hove, you need the Vav He. So then you only have to use two He's and a Vav. So the first two letters of God's name represent the past and the future. And the last two letters represent the present. As long as Amalek is in the world, you can still see God in the world, past and future. Look in the Torah, you'll see God in the past. Look in the Navi, you'll see God in the future. You know where it's hard to see God? In the present. So the Vav He is missing. Okay, based on that, we can now apply it why the man is the Yud and the woman is the He. The woman is the He, which is Hoya, first letter of past. The woman provides the past. And the man is the Yud, is the Yihyeh, he provides the future, meaning the following. The basic role of the woman is to create a environment, a home, an anchor to the past. To anchor the Jewish home in tradition. The woman creates that home, the home is tradition, the home is the anchor to the past. So the woman provides the foundation of the Jewish home. The man is there to learn Torah, to create a future for on that anchor, to add to it, right? To do all those things that are added to the base, that are done on the base. He goes and davens and he learns and he adds on the base that the woman creates. The woman creates the link to the past, the man creates the future. So what's missing? The present. But it's not missing. Because it doesn't say Ish Isha Shchina Shruya Beneihem. It says Ish V'Isha. The Vav that connects them, right? That's the Yud Kei Vav Kei. That's the present. The man is the future, the woman the past. Together, they create the present. And then, therefore, all three letters that are significant, because the He is just repeated, of Yud Kei and Vav, are all there. So that's what it means, that Ish V'Isha Shchina Shruya Beneihem. It's not just the Yud and the He, there's the Vav also. Okay, next thing. Don't look for any connection between any of these things. There isn't. If you want to do it, you can give another shiur. They're just things from the Sedra. And when B'no Slavchad come, and they ask a good question. They said, look, our father died. He left no sons. We're the ones who can inherit from him. Why should his portion be lost for Klal Yisrael, because there's no sons? So God gave the parsha of Yerusha that if there are no sons, the daughters inherit. Daughters do not inherit when there are sons. Now, that is a big bone of contention by feminists, right? But that's the way the Rabban Shalom made the world. But if it makes any feel any better, I'm talking to the people in the back, I'll tell you what the girls do get. Let's say there is a Yerusha, usually not in the millions, right? That's unusual. Usually, you have Yerusha in thousands, tens of thousands, whatever. The boys get the Yerusha. They split up the whole Yerusha. However, before they get a penny, all the expenses for the girls, till they marry, are taken out of the estate and given to the girls, and they split it up. Whatever's left, the boys split up. And if there's nothing left, the boys have to go beg. So, yeah, the truth is that girls don't get a share in the Yerusha, but they get everything off the top to take care of them till they're married and on their own. So, I don't know which is better, in any case. But that's the halacha. Okay, in any case. So, when Moshe Rabbeinu said, okay, I got to go ask a shayla to the Ribbono Shel Olam. The answer that was given before the answer of how they would inherit, in other words, the halachic answer, God prefaced it with another sentence. Kain b'no slavcha dovros. They said something good. They asked a good question. Good question. Why did God have to say that? You should have answered them what the halacha was. What I have to say was every time somebody comes to ask me a shayla, I don't say, hey, that was a good question. I answered a question, right? To say it was a good question, not a good question. My Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Gifter Zatzal, learned from here that if somebody does something good, you have to tell them they did something good. B'no Slavchad asks a good question, you have to tell them that they asked something good. If somebody's doing something good, you have to encourage them. You can't just remain indifferent. Yiddishkeit is not a religion where you can stand on the sidelines and cheer. You have to get involved. And I have a proof to that from a Medrash. The Medrash says, whoever mentions a tzaddik and doesn't bless him transgresses the pasuk Zecher tzaddik livracha. You mention a tzaddik, bless him. Whoever mentions a rosh and doesn't curse him has the same thing. What does that mean? You like tzaddikim, you're mentioning them, do something. Give them a bracha. Encourage them. Right? You can't stand and just be indifferent. Say you like the idea. If you like the idea, do something about it. Give them a bracha. You don't like wicked people, curse them. Do something about it. The minimum. I think that's the same idea of the following Gemara. The Gemara says, Kol anehena misudas chasa, ve'eno misamcho, over behekolos. Person who enjoys the meal of a chasa, but doesn't make him happy, so he transgresses the five voices of kol sasom, v'kol simcha, kol chasam, v'kol kala, kol omrim hodu l'ashem. So I like to explain it the following way. What it means is a person who enjoys marriage. In other words, I think it's a great institution, marriage. Right? I'm all for it. But he doesn't do anything to encourage this marriage. What's the purpose of being misameh chasam v'kala? To give them a base for their marriage of happiness that they can draw on their whole life. You start off the foundation with 7 days of simcha. So it gives them something to draw on for the whole life. So somebody who enjoys the idea of marriage, he's there, he's enjoying this marriage, but he doesn't do anything to encourage it, to promote it. He's not misameach, the chasen and kala, so he misses the point. The point is not to admire good things. The point is to get involved and do something to promote them. Don't just admire them from afar. Okay. Next. This question always bothered me. I have an answer, but somebody has a better answer, I'd like to hear it. It says that B'no Slavcha, the women, didn't die in the Midbar. It was only the men between 20 and 60 that died out. The women did not sin, not by the golden calf, and not by the sins of the spies. And the proof we have is that the women, not only didn't they detest and were disgusted with Eretz Yisrael like the men, they were mechabed Eretz Yisrael. They endeared. They thought Eretz Yisrael was precious. Where do we know that from? B'no Slavchad. Because they came and they wanted to share in Eretz Yisrael. So you see, that simple idea, that they considered Eretz Yisrael precious. They wanted to share. Lama nigara shem achinu. Avinu. It's always bothered me, where do you see from there that they had Eretz Yisrael precious? Let's say God was giving them a place in Timbuktu, not Eretz Yisrael. They still would have come with the same complaint, right? We're losing our money. We want to share. It has nothing to do with Eretz Yisrael. Where do you see from there that they appreciated Eretz Yisrael? They wanted to share because they wanted money. If it would have been somewhere else, they would have said the same thing, not only because it was Eretz Yisrael. Where did the rabbis see from here that it was Eretz Yisrael that motivated them and not a Yerusha? Right? If the Yerusha would have been somewhere else, they probably would have wanted it too. They didn't want to give up their share in their father's estate. Where do you see that it had to do with Eretz Yisrael? That's the question. Yeah.
Ultimately, whoever they married, they would have their share in the Eretz Yisrael.
Okay.
It wouldn't be in their father's name. It's a lachla. They wanted the nachla to continue the olam to shake its lachla.
So what does that do with Eretz Yisrael? What does that do with Eretz Yisrael?
Because it only happens in Eretz Yisrael.
But no.
Other places you can sell land.
I understand, but that has nothing to do with, per se, with Eretz Yisrael. Right, because they're mechaber there as Israel. They wanted let's say the land would be in Rhode Island. Right, and it wouldn't be on their name. It wouldn't be on their name.
No.
Right, if it wouldn't be on their name. They want it just as much. Right, it happened to be in Eretz Israel that the land went to whichever shave it was. So they weren't. Okay, that's a different story. Now you're on to what I'm going to say. Okay. It has nothing to do with the fact that they wanted a portion. That's money. It has even nothing to do with the fact that they wanted the portion on their name, because even if it would be in Rhode Island, because they're going to go to my husband's family. We're going to lose it. My family, my kids, my grandchildren aren't going to get it. His grandchildren are going to get it, if they're not the same, right? What showed that they appreciate Eretz Yisrael is they said the following: Loma nigora shem avinu. What does that do with shem avinu? Right? It's nothing missing with your father. You're missing for your pocket. Loma nigora chelkenu. Why should we lose out a portion? What does it do with the father? They said, our father's name is embellished by having a connection to Eretz Yisrael. That shows that they felt not having this portion is not something missing in our pocketbook. It's something missing in the name of our family because we don't have a kesher to Eretz Yisrael. That shows the chavivus. The way that they phrased it, not what they wanted. What they wanted could have been in Rhode Island. But loma nigora shame avinu. Why should the name of our father, right, be diminished because his children don't have a chelik in Eretz Yisrael? What kind of name diminished? His pocketbook, his bank account is diminished. What is his name? Obviously they felt that having a connection to Eretz Yisrael makes you a different person. It embellishes you. That showed that they were mechabed Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Next. Moshe Rabbeinu is told that he's going to die, and he asked the Rabbanu Shel Olam to appoint a leader in his place. They wanted a what? No, but the fact that they thought that it's a covet to their father to be connected to Eretz Yisrael shows that Eretz Yisrael in their eyes is something precious. Otherwise, what's the covet? Okay. So Moshe Rabbeinu asks for a leader to take their place. First of all, I once explained in the past that the way Moshe Rabbeinu described his job description is different than what the people thought his job description was when they thought he was gone the first time by Har Sinai, when they made the eagle. They came to Aaron when they thought Moshe was gone, and they said, Kum asei lanu Elohim, make us a power. Right? Ki ze Moshe ha'ish, asher yelchu lefanenu, who will walk in front of us. Ki ze Moshe ha'ish, lo yadanu mehoi. We don't know what happened to this man, Moshe. We need somebody to take his place. So they only wanted a replacement for Moshe, but they said Moshe being flesh and blood, you know, we couldn't count on him, so we'd like something a little bit more durable, make something out of gold, right? And we'll have that same kind of power that'll walk in front of us. That's the way they describe Moshe's function, asher yelchu lefanenu. The leader walks in front of the people. Moshe Rabbeinu said, no, we need a leader, and he described the job description. Asher yetze lifnehem, v'asher yavo lifnehem, v'asher yotzien, v'asher yivien. Who will go out before them and come back before them. Who will take them out and bring them in. What's the difference between them? So I always like to say the difference is illustrated by the following machlokas. The Gemara says, whoever has a sick person in his home, Mishiesh l'chola b'sobeso, yelech etzel chacham, should go to a Talmud Chacham, v'yavakish olav rachmim. Simple meaning, and that's what the Nemukah Yosef says, should go to the Talmud Chacham, the Talmud Chacham will daven for him. Go to a Talmud Chacham, have the Talmud Chacham daven, and we do that. We go to Tzadikim, we go to Talmidei Chachamim, we ask them to daven for sick people. And the Nemukah Yosef says, that's why the minig is to make mishaberachs in shul, by the Kriyas HaTorah, because usually Rabbanim are in shul, and they'll answer Amen, so you've had the Talmud Chacham daven for your sick person. The Meiri says a completely different pshat in that Gemara. The Meiri says if you have someone sick in your home, go to a chacham and he'll teach you how to daven for the person who's sick. Not that he'll daven for you. He'll teach you how to do it. He doesn't have a direct line more than you do. Everybody has a direct line. Except some people don't know how to dial. So the chacham will teach you how to dial. He won't do it for you. That, and could be the Nemuka Yosef agrees. It's just a matter of practicality. Right? The guy's sick. Until he teaches you how to daven, the guy may drop dead. So, you know, so he'll daven for you, right? First he'll make the call, and then he'll teach you how to dial for the next time. But the main thing is he should teach you how to do it. The Jewish people saw the leader going in front, the trailblazer. He's going to do it for us. And Moshe Rabbeinu said that's not what a leader is. A leader brings out the potential of the people and guides them, right, to be able to bring out the potential, but he only shows them how to do it themselves, not does it for them. That's the difference. And that explains the following Medrash, I think. The Medrash says that what was God's response to Moshe Rabbeinu? He, right after this, is the sacrifices. So Rashi brings down the Chazal that God said to Moshe, before you command me about my children to get them a leader, why don't you command my children about me to bring sacrifices? And it gives a marshal. There was a queen who was dying. She called her husband, the king, in, and she said, please take care of my children. After I'm dead, take care of our children. The king said, before you tell me to take care of your children, tell your children to honor me and respect me properly. Same thing here, the Rabbanu Shalom. What's the idea? I was thinking the idea is the following. The whole idea of sacrifices is to bring out the potential that's in a person, right, to elevate all the different powers in the world in service of God. Okay. And so the Rabbanu Shalom told Moshe Rabbeinu the following. Instead of telling me to appoint a leader, first the Jewish people have to be fit to follow a leader. They have to know that the leader is not going to do it for them. They have to have all these powers potentially that the leader then can instruct them how to bring them out. So first tell them about the sacrifices, and let them bring out these, develop these powers, and then we'll have a leader who will be able to guide them or whatever. That's the same thing with the king and the queen. The king said, of course I'm going to take care of my kids, but then it's only from the outside. I'll take care of them because of my kids. But if you tell the kids to deserve it, then my relationship with them is going to be a lot better. It's going to come from them. It's not going to come just artificially one-sided from me. Same thing over here. A leader who has to do it for the people, it's a one-sided thing. But if he guides them and they do it, then it comes from them. That's much better. Okay. Therefore, since that's the purpose of a leader, Moshe Rabbeinu invoked God as the Elokei Haruchos L'chol Basar. God is the power of all the spirits of people. Meaning people are all different, have all different emotions, different characters, personalities. A leader has to know how to deal with each person individually. And sometimes Rashi says there's two different girsas in Medrash. One is Rashi says that he knows how to go against the spirit of each person. Another one says he knows how to deal with the spirit of each person. You need both. Sometimes the leader has to lead people according to their nature. He has to know their nature. He has to know how to deal with people according to their nature. But he tells one person not the same thing as another person. They're different people. But sometimes he has to know go against the nature. Sometimes the person, because of his nature, is doing things negative. And you need to go against that nature. So the leader has to be sensitive to the nature of each person, sometimes to enhance that nature and sometimes to suppress that nature. That's the way that a leader works.
Sort of like
shift of Homishantacha. What? Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's, but even in the shift of Homishantacha sometimes. Right? Okay, same idea. Okay. Now let's do something about Bein HaMetzarim, and that will give a siyum to the shir. It is already Shivasa B'Tammuz. According to some, Bein HaShmoshes already starts the halachas. If you forgot to take a haircut, you could still take a haircut till Tzeis HaKochavim, if you have to. In any case, or if you want to get married, also there's still time. We're going to now come to the 3 weeks, which are broken up from Shavuos v'Tammuz till Rosh Chodesh Av, then Rosh Chodesh Av till the seventh day of Av, different Chomer, and then the seventh day of Av till Erev Tisha B'Av, or Shavuos Shechal Bo Tisha B'Av, the week that Tisha B'Av falls in, is more strict. Erev Tisha B'Av is more strict, and finally Tisha B'Av. And then after Tisha B'Av, it's all over. And the Shabbos after Tisha B'Av is big simcha. So, L'cha'orah, that is the opposite of what a normal morning is. Right? If the Rabbanim wanted to establish mourning for the Beis HaMikdash on a yearly basis, what they should have done is the following. They should have said, started with Tisha B'Av. That is like the day of death. Then they should have made 7 days after Tisha B'Av strict days of mourning like Shiva. And then the remainder till the end of Shloshim. And that's it. That's how a normal Avelis is. You start with the most strict, and then you go less intense, till the Avelis is over. Why here is it the opposite? So first you have to understand why Avelis works the way that it does. It says that after a year, there's a gzeira min hashem, a special decree from heaven, shehames nishtakach min halev, that the person is forgotten from the heart. Now that doesn't mean if you have a loved one and they die, a year later you forget who it was. Right? The Avelis is ridiculous. Nobody ever forgets the people they're mourning for. But the idea is that when a person dies, right, a loved one dies, it hits you like a ton of bricks emotionally. And it's all in your heart. It's all emotion. It's hard to control it. It's hard to get back to life as usual. You're beset by emotions that debilitate you to a certain degree. So the Torah understood that. The rabbis understood that. And they realized, like a deep sea diver can't come up all at once. You have to ventilate those feelings and be able to get them out. And then by a year, they're no longer emotional. They're able to be controlled intellectually too. They're forgotten from the heart, meaning they're no longer in the jurisdiction of the heart completely. They're able to be controlled partially by the mind, or a good portion by the mind. It's still there, but it's more controllable. So the day of death is the most intense. We don't bother you, right? Then Shiva dissipates the feeling a little bit more. Shloshim a little bit more, as it gets less and less, till you can get back to normal life.
Can I ask a question? Does that apply like little children losing parents at an early age? Do they experience the loss in an emotional part of the heart, or does it stay with them longer in the heart more than
I'm not sure. The truth is, there's no chinuch. Yeah. A child is not bar mitzvah, doesn't go through any avelis, because they're not capable of. There's no chinuch afilo for that. For Avelis. We don't make them sit Shiva. They don't have any of these laws applied to them unless they're bar mitzvah or bas mitzvah. So it could be for a child, it's impossible for them to deal with this either emotionally, or they need other people to help them through it. It's not something they can deal with on their own. Right. So that is what's it called? That is by regular Avelis.
But adults who don't go through the process.
Right, well,
still
something's
in the heart 10 years later.
Right, could be. In any case, so the Avelis for the Beis HaMikdash can't be like that. Because we couldn't come to Tisha B'Av and be hit like a ton of bricks emotionally with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We're so used to a world without a Beis HaMikdash that it doesn't make any impression on us. We don't know what the world's like with a Beis HaMikdash. You can't really feel bad that there is none. So here you have to do the opposite. You have to build up a little bit intellectually, right? You start, what's it called, not taking haircuts, not getting married, not listening to music for a certain amount of time. And it gets you into the mood of something's wrong. Then a little bit more, until on Tisha B'Av you build up to feel that mourning. That's one idea. Second idea is the whole cycle of destruction. God didn't destroy the Beis HaMikdash. He prepared us for it. Right, first he brought the Goyim and they besieged Yerushalayim. Then they broke through the siege. Then they finally destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. And we fast throughout the year like that. Sor B'Teves, Shivah Sor B'Tammuz, and Tisha B'Av. What's the idea? The idea is that God didn't destroy the Beis HaMikdash to hurt us. He did it because we were on a suicide path, like other nations were. The rise and fall of the Roman Empire, right? They became so corrupt or whatever that they basically committed suicide and disappeared from the annals of history into the history books. And that could have happened to us. We were on a suicidal course. So the Rabbanu Shlomo won't let that happen to us. So he shocks us. That's what it means. He took his anger out on stones and wood of the Beis HaMikdash, not on us. Because that was enough to shock us into maybe a long period of rehabilitation that took so far 2,000 years and hopefully is almost over. But it's all for the sake of getting everything back. And sometimes you have to do something drastic, because if you don't, you're going to lose the person. The example I always like to give, which women find a very hard time hearing,
right?
So if it's hard for you to hear, I understand, but I can make the mashal any way I want, so don't argue with me. Okay? I'll tell you what the mashal is. You have this 5-year-old brat who is super strong, super stubborn, and the biggest thing he likes to do is to play chicken with semi-trailers, speeding down the road. Whenever he sees a semi-trailer, he runs in front of it, right? And this kid doesn't understand that if he's hit by the semi-trailer, that's it, right? He watches television. He sees people hit by cars, and next week they're back on the show. So, you know, it's not no big deal. So he doesn't understand. The mother has spoken to him nicely, you know, with modern-day things. How do you feel about being hit by a semi-trailer or whatever? Mamala, you know, we don't do those kinds of things. And then that didn't work, right? The kid ignored her completely. Then she yelled at him. That didn't help. Then she poached him. That didn't help. Nothing helps every time. Now, the mother's walking with the kid. And she sees this semi-trailer coming down the road, speeding 90 miles an hour. And she feels the kid pulling away from her. And he's super strong. She can't restrain him. And she knows in 2 minutes he's going to pull away, run in front of the truck. There's no way the truck can stop. That's the end of her kid. She has an iron pole in her other hand. There's only one thing she can do. Break his legs. Breaks his legs, he can't run onto the street. If you were the mother, would you break your kid's legs? Don't tell me, well, there's something else. There's nothing else. I made up the marshal. That's it. It's black and white. Either you break the kid's legs or he runs in front of the truck. Right, there is no other option. Okay, I'm telling you, there's no option. Those are the only two options I'm giving you. If you knew those are the only two options, would you break your kid's legs? Yes. Out of love. When you broke them, you'd break them out of love. And if you didn't break your kid's legs, then you didn't love him that much. Because obviously he's going to get killed. Right. So to save his life, I'll break his legs. So the Rabbanu Shlom broke our legs to save our lives. That's the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. But he didn't do that. That's not the first line of action, right? If you have a little kid, right, and he's trying to go into the street, you don't break his legs. First you talk to him, you yell at him, you hit him, right? The last resort is, if nothing helps, and that's the only option, then you break his legs. So the Rabbanu Shlom, first he let the Goyim come and besiege us. We should have learned the lesson. We didn't. Then they broke through the city. We didn't learn the lesson then. Finally destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. Every year we relive that. And if we'd learned the lesson from Asar B'Teves, we wouldn't have to come to Shiva Asar B'Tammuz. If we learned the lesson of Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, we wouldn't have to come to the 3 weeks. If we learned the lesson of the 3 weeks, we wouldn't have to come to the 9 days. It's a reliving of this every year and any generation where the Beis HaMikdash wasn't built, like it was destroyed. It's an ongoing process. So therefore, the Avelis gets from lesser to more because God is giving us a chance to relive it. And hopefully, before he has to break our legs again, we're going to be able to rectify the situation.